Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have in the studio, he joined us, I guess it was about a month or so ago, to help us out with a fundraiser here in WEAA with his new book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, What It Means to Be Black Now, a book that's just been named one of the top 100 books of the year by the New York Times. He was in Bill Maher, I saw that one on the air, author, journalist, cultural critic, thinker, troublemaker, TV star, Touré. Welcome.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Good to have you in the studio. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us. 410-319-8888. Welcome to Baltimore. You're going to be speaking in just a little while to at the library downtown, the Central Branch.
Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to that.
That's going to be good. You should have a good crowd. Should be a good group of people coming out.
A lot of great people in Baltimore, so I'm happy to get here, talk to the people, see what's going on.
It'll be jammed. It'll even make it more jammed because you're listening to The Steiner Show and need to go to the library tonight at 7:30, finish listening to the show, or drive and head on down on Cathedral Street to Central Branch, and Touré will be there talking. And Michael Eric Dyson's joining as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, you know, some of the people will come for me, but a lot of people will come out for Mike Dyson because he's amazing. He's brilliant. And he's just, you know, he did a thing about his Jay-Z class the other day on the Today Show. And he said, we're trying to make the life of the mind sexy. And I love that. I love that. Because why should it be, you know, boring and just, you know, old things that don't matter to anybody anymore? It should be fun. You know, like, why can't you, you know, engage people's minds intellectually while talking about Jay-Z or The Wire or, you know, something from modern popular culture, you know, which is just as good a stage to talk about some of these things as anything. You know, I spend a whole chapter in my book Deconstructing Chappelle's Show.
That's one of the questions I want to talk to you about. Here you talked about Chappelle in the book. I was going to wait till later, but since you brought it up.
Well, just popular culture is a way to deal with serious things going on in the world.
But, I mean, Chappelle was one of those guys who in this all these plethora of people you interviewed, you actually pulled out an old interview that you used with him.
Well, you can't, you know, I interviewed 105 people. I interviewed everybody who was a significant part of the Chappelle Show creative team.
Right.
But you can't get Chappelle on the phone. I mean, you know, he's not talking to anybody, so, you know, I couldn't talk to him. But I fortunately, I had spoken with him for BET right after he came back from South Africa, so I did have an hour with him in the past.
It's so, you know, I didn't, the piece you kind of, one of the pieces you focused on that chapter on Chappelle, I didn't want to jump there yet, but you raised it, so I'll raise it, because I think it's really interesting and emblematic of some of the discussion in the book on the notion of post-blackness, is Clayton.
And Clayton Bigsby.
Yes, Clayton
Bigsby. Yes, the black man who's blind and thinks he's white and becomes a Klansman.
We were watching that the other night. But it really says a lot about the places that Chappelle is willing to go.
Well, yeah. I mean, I spent a bunch of time focusing just on the introduction to the Clayton Bigsby sketch. That's the first episode of the show. And Chappelle talks about showing the sketch to a friend of his. And I don't know if he actually did this or not. You know, maybe it's just a setup. He says he showed the sketch to a friend, and the friend said, you set the race back with a comedy sketch. And he just shrugs. And then he plays the sketch. And the thing I love about that is that he's showing you right off the bat, I am not constrained by the burden of representation. I don't need to make the race look great in everything I do. And in doing this piece, which is so satirical and so ugly funny and so brilliant but messed up, that he says something very deep about what it means to be black and white in America today. But because he's freed from, like, well, I have to make sure black people look good in everything that I do, then he's able to actually be a much more complex and valuable artist.
Right. No, absolutely. That was and that was a very
I mean, if you're constantly worried about what will white people think if I do this or I do that, then you're going to be constrained in what you can do. And as a person, maybe you can get away with it, though that's a heavy burden to walk around with. But as an artist, you have no chance of truly succeeding and being a powerful artist on any realm.
But in this, in what you're describing, though, whether Chappelle and many other things in your book that the people you talk to, and you make it clear that you're sick and tired of trying to worry about doing things that's going to get white folks upset. It's time to stop worrying about that, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, not on the other hand, but also, There's some things like Chappelle's piece, a number of pieces I can mention that pull out of your book, that a lot of the black community be upset about, especially established folks get real upset about, right? I mean, because it's we're moving into a different era, and that becomes a territory where when you tread on it, people don't know how to react to it yet.
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that when you get to a certain level of maturity, intellectual maturity as a black person, you learn to reject the white gaze, G-A-Z-E, the white gaze. So I'm not doing things because I'm afraid of what white people say, but I'm not also not doing things as a sort of middle finger to the white man. I'm just doing the things that I want to do because that's what I like to do. That's the way I like to perform who I am in public.
But people take it as a middle finger sometimes.
Well that's right? That's on them.
Exactly.
I'm just doing me. I'm not doing me right. As a response to the white gaze, white people watching. The higher level of intellectual maturity for black people is to also learn to reject the black gaze. So I'm not doing things or not doing things to get a reaction from or because of the eye of black people. I'm just doing myself as I want to do myself, as I think is valuable and necessary for me.
I mean, it's like Zadie Smith says early in your book, that we're feeling boxed in by the notion of keeping it real.
Oh, keeping it real is such a prison. I mean, it's a total prison. Chappelle deals with this, and when keeping it real goes wrong, and you know when his mentor in the corporation does that thing that happens occasionally that's so annoying when the white person sort of affects black culture
right.
as some way of like, hey, we're cool. Give me some skin. What's up, brother? Nice one. Bro ham. And you're like, oh, my God. This is so annoying. I can't believe you just did that. And, you know, keeping it real suggests maybe, you know, you cock back and you knock them out or you know, you show them what's real, you know, and that's not, that's a caricaturish, cartoonish example of it. But, you know, I mean, just this concept of keeping it real. I mean, look, keeping it real has got to be individualized. You know, if I keep it real, it has nothing to do with the ghetto. That's not where I'm from. So, you know, if I keep, you know, been keeping it real seems to always want to relate to, you know, working class mores. But I, you know, if I keep it real for me, it has nothing to do with that.
It's working class mores. It's also what you say kind of threads through the book here a lot, which is that it's any part of society can be like this, but blackness is defined by periods of time in some ways.
Well, of course.
You know what I'm saying? I mean,
sure.
So keeping it real can mean somebody who came up in your father's generation to say keeping it real. If they looked at you as keep it real, man. Just keep it real.
Well, the thing I want to do with this book is give everybody the freedom and the liberation to be black however they want to be. So keep it real is defined by each individual person. Skip Gates talks about it. There's 40 million black people. There's 40 million ways to be black. So, you know, keep it real for this person, Jalen Rose. It's not the same as keep it real for Grant Hill. And they both are legitimately and authentically black in their own way.
So, by the way, folks, this is live tonight. He's not Memorex. 410-319-8888 is the number to call. We're talking with Touré. His book is Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. Michael Eric Dyson wrote the foreword. Both he and Michael will be at Central Branch of the Library at 7:30 tonight talking and enjoying a conversation with you all. But you can join that now here as well at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. One of the things, there's so many things I was thinking about as I was reading this book, and one of the things is that, you know, when you wrestle with certain things here, different people's reactions, one of the things I was looking at, the different people you interviewed, did you find a difference between how people would define the idea of post-blackness, what it means to be black in America, in 2011, between political figures and the artists?
Well,
I was feeling that in the book a lot.
Sure. I mean, look, everybody comes at it from their own perspective and where they are in life. So yeah, absolutely. Different people are doing it or looking at it different ways. But part of the beauty of post-blackness that I'm talking about is that everybody can define blackness for themselves. So I wouldn't be able to impose upon anybody, well, this is what it means. What I'm doing is liberating the definition that you can choose to be black the way that you want to be black. Now, this does not erase blackness in any way. This does not end blackness. It's not that it becomes infinite and thus it becomes nothing. I think there is still some sort of center, but it's not that we're saying these artifacts or these beliefs, you know, or these ways of performing it are more authentic or are prized above these ones, that they're all equal. And that, you know, like one thing I noticed, you deal drugs to the community and you go to jail, nobody questions your blackness, you know, right? You go to private school and then you get into Yale and it's like, well, you know, maybe he's selling out. Maybe he forgot who he is. Maybe he's not really black anymore. Like, I mean, this is a completely upside down and bizarre turn of events. I mean, you know, a drug dealer who goes to jail are actually, you know, contributing to damaging the community, killing individuals in the community. You, who goes to private school and ends up at Yale, are trying to move up a little bit and perhaps bring some wealth into the community. So why would we, you know, sort of embrace one and kick out the other? It's just completely backwards.
I mean, we're going to go to the phones here in a minute. Rob and Cooper, the first who call us up, we're going to come to your calls here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Touré, who's afraid of post-blackness. The TV show, why am I blocking the name of the show? Your show.
The Hip Hop Shop?
No, the one where we did where you jumped out of the plane.
Oh, I'll try anything once.
Try anything once. That's right. Try anything once. So two reactions. So here you are getting ready to, you begin the book, getting ready to jump out of this airplane.
Yeah.
And on your way there, you meet four older black men at a restaurant. And they go,
They say, what are you doing here in the middle of Florida Panhandle? And it's, I'm going to go skydiving. And they say, black people don't do that. And I'm on my way with the four other people in the group are all white. They don't know that only one of them is actually going to go skydiving. The other three are not going to be jumping out of the plane at all. But they look at the group of people with me and they're like, see, that proves it, that you're going skydiving with a bunch of white people. What is wrong with you, brother?
But then you go to the NASCAR thing, and you have I think if I remember this right, there's a woman who is descended from Klansmen or something.
Yeah, her grandfather was a local.
Saying that if you had come here 4 years ago, or just last year, whatever year that was, that you wouldn't have been able to get in.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of juxtaposing those two reactions to these allegedly unblack things that you're about to do.
Well, sure. Two very interesting stories. I mean, with the skydiving, you know, I went skydiving even though I was told black people don't do that. And, you know, I had an amazing sort of epiphany after I jumped out of the plane, that when the parachute opened and I'm looking at the earth from 4,000 feet above, and I'm like, there must be a God. I mean, you know, I am such a tiny pebble in this world. We're all so tiny. There must be a higher force. And that just helped me grow a little bit as a human being. I wasn't an atheist before, but I wasn't totally sure, you know. And I thought there's something. And that moment told me there must be something larger than us. The demolition derby incident in the middle of Indiana was heavy in a whole other way, in that I'm at this demolition derby site, you know, about to go do this crash bang thing with these guys who they would not be insulted to be called rednecks. That's what they are. They would embrace that term themselves, and that's what we understand them to be. And I mean, there are people with Confederate flags on their hats, on their cars, on their jacket, all over the place. You know, I'm the only black person as far as I can see. I'm like, what am I doing? Like, this is insane. Like, why? For television? Like, you're crazy. And this woman who had been demolition derby, or her stepfather was my mentor. He was going to be in there in the race with me. She made a big thing to, she's extremely Christian, took her Christianity very, very seriously, and made a thing to hold my hand with her husband and her kids, and we made a prayer circle kind of in the middle of the parking lot where everybody was getting their cars ready. And we prayed for my safety during the race. But what also happened is that somebody who was known in this community was holding hands with me and saying, you know, I stand with this person and you're not going to treat him differently, and you're just going to treat him like everybody else out here. And that was a very powerful message. And I was not, before that moment, I was kind of like, wow, like all these white people I'm afraid of and nerve, because people are coming up to me and shaking my hand and saying hello, but you're wearing a Confederate flag on your hat. And I'm kind of like, I don't know if I can trust you. And, you know, I needed to trust somebody or I probably would have had a nervous breakdown. And she allowed me to trust her and also to feel like, hey, look, you don't have to be afraid of all these people. You know, there are some good people here. So when we start the race, some of the people in the crowd are giving me the finger when they're announcing my name. They're just like, you know, screw this guy. Some kids came up to my camera crew who were all white. They said, are you with the N-word? And they're like, well, yeah, well, because he's not welcome around here. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah.
But when we got into the actual race, it actually went very well because all these guys do these demolition derbies every weekend. So they had all these rivalries amongst each other. And I'm new. Nobody has a rivalry against me. So they all kind of left me alone. And they were fighting each other as they do every other weekend. And I was able to sort of like, you know, figure it out and get my legs under me. And I finished actually fifth in the whole thing out of like 15, 20 cars or something like that. It was pretty amazing.
Fun. 410-319-8888. Tory is with us. The book, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. He'll be at the Enoch Pratt Library downtown at 7:30 tonight, along with Michael Eric Dyson. And this was selected as one of the 100 books of 2011 by the New York Times. 410-319-8888. Rob, you're on the air.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks,
thank
Rob.
Thank you, Brother
Tory.
Hi, Rob. All I really want to basically say is the fact that, you know, I'm always amazed that and how, you know, we as a people, we place so many limitations on ourselves without having to do so. I've always said, for example, that religion, I like your religion basically to this. I like your religion as herpes. And I know it's going to sound crazy, but I want to say something to get your attention. The reason why I say this is because religion to me is the oppression that keeps on giving. Because I think... And I'm not going to go on any type of anti-religious rant. I do have a point to my babbling. But the reason why I say that is because the fact that, you know, religion and Christianity in particular has been such limiting factors in our lives. Because, you know, we've always been taught we can't do this because, you know, we'll fall outside of God's grace, that kind of thing. And we apply these types of thinking to every other facet of our lives. I remember growing up as a child. And I grew up in a very modest background. You know, I had an uneducated mother, an uneducated father, the whole nine, the whole litany, every other stereotype you can think of that applied to me and my background. And yet, I somehow made it, and I went to grad school, you know, became a teacher. I've been teaching for years.
It's but amazing.
My point, though, is that transition, when I was in school and working and so forth, and I was always, you know, attuned to how I was communicating, how I was coming across, I was also, of course, I'm sure you've heard this and probably been told this or at least heard this. Why are you trying to act white? Why are you talking white? And that always perplexed me as far as why would you think I'm trying to be white? If anything, most militants, if you listen to them speak, are some of the more articulate black people you ever come across.
That's right.
You know, that's one thing that most people don't realize. Not that I'm militant, but my point, though, is that just because you're articulate, that doesn't mean you're, quote-unquote, selling out. And my last and final point is basically this. I feel like, you know, as long as we continue to think this way as far as placing limiting factors on ourselves, at our own behest, and no longer, you know, at the will of the greater majority or mainstream, we're always going to be behind eight ball and behind the curve because, you know, we don't really foster in our community that open-mindedness or that sense of creativity. I mean, I see it all the time. I see right. it where it's so...
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
I see a young mother in a mall and her child, you know, might, you know, do something most children do.
Well, let me Tory jump in because there's a ton of callers behind you that want to jump in.
I'll let it go, but thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, brother.
You make a lot of excellent points. I mean, it bothers me that this idea that, you know, you're trying to attain more education and be articulate and these sort of things is sort of acting white or selling out. I mean, it's absurd. I mean, doing the things that could put you in a position to succeed in politics or in business is equal to acting white or becoming white. That's absurd. And I don't think there's any other demographic that does that demonizes those members who are trying to move up in the world.
No, different cultures are doing it in different ways, but not the same thing. Not even near the same thing.
No.
But you talk about this also. An interesting little twist. This was your conversation in the book about where acting white came from, and talking about its root in slavery and what it meant.
Well, I mean, I talked to sociologists and historians about it, and they talked about that acting white assertion starting in slavery, and that, you know, the blacks who would sort of adopt, mores that mimicked Massa might think that they would have a little more control over where they would go or be sold for a little bit more money. And the attack would be in that you are not participating in what you are gaining here, right? You're not getting anything out of this. Now, just flash forward to today, you know, if you go to a job interview for a serious job and you say axe, you are not getting the job. I'm sorry. You are not getting that job. And that's just a subtle sort of cue that you're sending out to the HR people that, you know, you speak a certain way, you know, you are a certain sort of person, you come from a certain background, you are not going to get elected, you are not going to get the job. Now, if you can flatten out your speech to where you can speak job English, you know, because there's a time and place for everything, you go to the hood, you speak whatever way you want to speak, you code switch, you go to the job, you speak job English, you know, and you get that money, you know, you bring it back to the community. And, you know, if you could do that, then you can move up and you can have a chance to become a president of the company. You know, the CEO of Xerox is a black woman, you know, the head of Amex for a long time is a black man. Right. The head of Merrill Lynch for a long time was a black man. Or you could be a vice president. Or you could be in the company long enough to learn whatever it is you need to learn to go off and be an entrepreneur and run your own smaller business. So, you know, the rewards now are far greater than they were in my parents' and my grandparents' generation, far, far more. So, I mean, you know, when the stakes are that high, it's kind of worth it to play the game.
So, well, I have a jump. 10 things I want to ask you from the book, but let me be fair and let listeners in here, and I'll come back to me. 410-319-8888. Cooper, you're on the air.
Thank you. I've been listening to Brother Torre, and I've heard him on other programs. I think his concept is absolutely ridiculous. But if it has any validity at all, I would assume it could be applied to other ethnic groups. If there is a post-racial or post-ethnic position that one could occupy, I would presume that it would be accessible, as I say, to others. So I'd like to ask Brother Torre, what would post-whiteness be?
Well, that's
I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you, Cooper.
That's a fine question. Not the first time that I've heard that. See, the thing is that white people have always been able to do whatever it is they wanted to do. And nobody was ever telling any white person, white people don't do that. Even if it's, you know, go down to the juke joints and hang out and listen to jazz with the black people. White people have never been constrained by whiteness. Black people are often constrained or has historically been constrained by what it means to be black, that blacks and whites are telling them black people don't do that. So the liberation that I'm talking about with this book is to say that anything a black person wants to do is something that is black, that you take your blackness and it's portable and you go skydiving, you go scuba diving, you go to yoga, you go to the ballet and watch Baryshnikov do his amazing stuff, go to some classical opera, whatever it is you, and then go back home to your black neighborhood or your black home and take that in with you. And that's just part of the experiences that make up who you are. So, you know, I mean, it's not at all equivalent to say, well, you know, if there's post-blackness, then there must be post-whiteness. They don't function in an equivalent way like that. And I think any time you try to understand race by making this sort of switch test, you know, you're going to get confused. It's not equivalent. You know, we could say, you know, well, if a white person said X to a black person, and then if a black person said X to a white person, then is it equally racist? No, that doesn't work at all. So the viability of post-blackness does not rest on the viability of post-whiteness. And, you know, it's part of what the caller has not fully understood about what I'm talking about is that post-blackness and post-racial are not at all synonymous. They're two entirely different words. Right. Post-racial is a bankrupt concept. It's a term for an idea that does not exist, that suggests that race no longer matters or that racism doesn't really matter anymore. I'm not really even sure that we as a society have a clear consensus on what post-racial means, but it's the meanings that I hear applied to it are not true. Obviously, race still matters quite a bit, and that racism still has a huge impact on society. With post-blackness, I'm merely talking about the complexity of what it means to be black now. See, one thing that some people may not realize is that I did not make up this term, post-black. Right. This was a term that comes from the art world, that Thelma Golden, the great curator from the Studio Museum of Harlem, and Glenn Ligon, the great visual artist, came up together to talk about a generation of artists they saw in the late 90s coming up who they felt wanted to be rooted in but not constrained by blackness, who they saw wanted to be artists who were not locked in by identity concerns. You know, to be a black artist is different, they saw, than to be an artist, especially an artist who happens to be black. So an artist who happens to be black has much more freedom to do anything they want in the world rather than a black artist who's constantly dealing with what it means to be black. You know, what it means to be black is also what it means to be human. So why would I constantly be talking about what it means to be black? I could talk about things that have nothing to do with blackness. So that's a little bit of sort of where that comes from, that concept. And I took it from an art world discussion into a real world discussion.
And we have to take a break from this real world discussion and come right back to continue it with Touré, who's afraid of post-blackness, what it means to be black now. When we come back, Jamila, you're in the next caller up. We have Timothy, Marcel, Maria, Lamont. We're going to get to your calls and to some of my questions, too, in between your calls. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with Touré, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, What It Means to Be Black Now. The foreword is by Michael Eric Dyson. Both he and Michael will be at the Enoch Pratt Central Branch at 7:30, an hour from now, so you can go on down there and hear them and talk to them there. He's also the author of Never Drank the Kool-Aid, Soul City, a novel, Portable Promised Land, short stories. He's been on TV, Hip Hop Shop, and On the Record, and has been a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. He ran off and left college and went to Rolling Stone and stayed there. Never looked back.
That's right. I mean, you know, when I was at college, nobody could explain to me why are we going through this liberal arts exercise and how does this lead to a job? And I could explain it to somebody now, but I asked everybody, my graduate student friends, the administrators, the professors, and nobody could give me an answer as to why we were doing this thing. And so I was interning at Rolling Stone. And I was constantly trying to talk to the writers and the editors about how do you become a writer. And finally, those efforts got me fired. But eventually, but I had made a friend in the record review department who gave me a chance to do a little record review, and then another and another. And 10-some years later, they couldn't get rid of me.
There you are.
Still there.
There you are. On the way to the phones here, Jamila, we're going to come to your call. There's a few things. One thing at least I want to get out here that I found interesting, because this era we've gone through, one of the things you wrote about in here was, I think this was in your voice, not somebody else's voice, because you interviewed all these incredible people, was that Obama was a game changer about how black folks think about everything, and it hasn't happened since King. You were writing towards the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that he so much was a game changer, maybe, but that moment in time is emblematic of a change.
It is emblematic of a change in a moment where, my kids, I got two little kids, they will grow up in a world that's entirely different than the world I grew up in, where they can believe that they could become president. And thus, perhaps they really would believe you can do anything, that the American dream is not a lie for black Americans, but it's actually true. I mean, I remember growing up, I wanted, when I was about 8, 9, 10, 11, I wanted to be the first black president. And I talked to that, I talked about that to a lot of people. And somewhere along the line, that just dissipated. And I talked to my mom about it and was like, when I was writing the book, and I was like, what happened to that? And she's like, I don't know. Like, you just stopped talking about that. And I think somehow society just kind of let me know that that was cockamamie and it wasn't going to happen. And when I applied to college, including to Johns Hopkins, I wrote essays about wanting to be a political advisor, like Richard Gere in the movie Power.
Right.
And looking back, I'm like, how sad that at 10 you wanted to be president, and by 17 you were saying, I want to be a political advisor. Like, I mean, you know, that's just sort of your dream downsizing, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I think my kids would not go through that because they would believe we can be president too. Now, has Obama himself made, you know, I mean, there was a moment for many African Americans, for many black Americans of coming home in the election of Barack Obama, and that, wow, we feel welcomed by the country. We feel fully part of America for once. But a lot of people report that it didn't last long for them, and they sort of were slapped back to reality, you know, before the first hundred days were over. And has Obama or his election made an unimpeachable change to America? I mean, in some ways, yes, in terms of race, some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. In many ways, no. And, you know, I mean, what we talk about, white supremacy has been chinked 0.001%, and after, you know, after 2016, it will go back to completely 100%. You know, and I say 2016 because I, 2 years ago, I looked at the GOP field and I said, there's not a person in the field who could possibly beat this guy. And now that we're basically down to two, looks like it's either going to be Romney or Gingrich. I'm like, well, neither of these guys can beat Barack Obama. I mean, that's crazy to think that either of these guys could beat him.
Well, they probably can't.
I don't
they
have any. I'm sure they can't.
It's a strange country.
Well, but one thing that we know, in 94% of elections, the candidate with the most money wins. Barack Obama, as the incumbent, will almost surely have way more money than Romney or Gingrich.
Pardon me.
You know, I can't see it. I can't see it happening. And the money is a key factor.
I think it's true. I think it's true. But I won't digress too deeply into Obama right now. Let's go back to these callers. 410-319-8888. Jamila, you're on the air.
Hey.
Hi, Jamila. Welcome.
Hi.
Hey, Jamila.
So my husband and I, Pierre, have been making these T-shirts since 2004 that say Black Nerds Unite.
Nice.
And at the time, it seemed like a way to insert like our style of quirkiness into the performance, into our personal performance of everyday blackness, and then also into the conversation like about what constitutes an authentic blackness.
Nice.
And then in the intervening years, we've seen nerdiness kind of come out of the closet and black nerdiness come out of the closet.
That's
and
right.
Like, you know, like in just much more public ways and people kind of being black in more quirky ways and more, you know, just Dungeons and Dragons-y ways or glasses wearing ways or just different like performances of nerdiness.
You listen to Childish Gambino?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Donald Glover.
Yeah.
He gives a twinkle to my eye.
I mean, he talks about that, and he talks about Questlove exactly. And the whole black nerd mafia. Absolutely. You got to include Obama and Kanye in there, too.
Exactly. Like, you look around and you see, like, these black nerds kind of stepping onto the world stage and making these, you know, beautiful moves. And I think that kind of thing of people who are quirky and alternative, like all the kind of an alterna blackness, kind of stepping out and being public and visible, I think is making a nice change and a nice variety, I should say.
I agree.
What is kind of allowed types of blackness. And I also wanted to say that when I first heard the title of your book, you know, 100 years ago when it was first flapping around, but it wasn't yet available. I was concerned, you know, like like, wait a minute, this is, we don't want to post black. But I just wanted to thank you for explaining it so well and kind of separating it from the post-racial concept, because I conflated the two concepts in my head. And when I heard the title of your book, I was like, uh-oh, where's the way going with it?
Yeah, a lot of people conflated it.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, we definitely had to unpack for a lot of people that post-black is entirely mm-hmm. different than post-racial. They're in two entirely different words. And the way you know that they're two different words is that they're spelled entirely differently.
But conceptually, you can hear the confusion.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I can, which is part of what inspired the title. But once you start to understand, once you actually start to read the book and understand what the concept is all about, then it's like, oh, you know, a lot of people say to me, you know, this concept is totally wrong. How could you say that? Black people can do anything they want to do. And like, well, you just defined the concept even while you're saying, I totally disagree with you. I mean, ultimately, this is about liberation, you know, that everybody can be black the way that they want to be black. And these sort of identity cops who want to police blackness and say, you're not legitimate, you're not authentic, you're not doing it right. You know, vanquish them, you know, and give people the freedom to do blackness the way they want to do it.
There are a couple of parts of this book, not a couple, a lot, but that really struck me in that how little has changed and how much has changed at the exact time in both these things I'm about to mention. One is the use of the N-word.
Mm.
That whole piece that you wrote in there, the conversations you had around that, that was very powerful, and why you came to a conclusion why you stopped using certain words, whether it's MF or N, why you stopped them.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really... Talk a bit about that.
Sure. I mean, for a long time, maybe 15-some years, I used the N-word colloquially, and I hate saying the N-word, but I will participate in the broadcast.
We do that because one of the things is this, the folks on the station here at Morgan don't like the word on the air.
I'm playing along for the broadcast. But as a writer and a person who cares about linguistics, saying the N-word I hate because it seems to give – the actual N-word more power in that we will discuss it, but we cannot even say it.
Yeah, right,
he
right.
whose name shall not even be mentioned. So I hate participating in that, but in a broadcast context, we have to play along. But for 15 years, I used the N-word colloquially because I felt what a lot of black men feel, that it's sort of we have empowering ourselves and we're recapturing the word and we're, you know, using this thing that has been this tool of oppression and we're recasting it into something different. And, you know, and I enjoyed playing that game and being part of that. And when the Obamas got into the White House, I said, does it really still fit the zeitgeist? Does it really still fit where we are right now as a country and as people, that this beautiful black family who we're proud of lives in the White House, for us to, in this sort of ironic postmodern way, call ourselves, you know, monsters, you know? And it no longer made sense for me. And so I had to stop doing it. But, you know, this word... In terms of being remixed, predates the hip-hop generation by quite a bit. And I think a lot of people in the hip-hop generation think this is our innovation that we made. I remember Richard Pryor using it. I remember Richard Pryor saying he wasn't going to use it anymore.
Right.
It goes back before that. Dick Gregory, a great comedian in the 60s, named his autobiography that. And I heard... as far back as the early 60s, some of the older black men who I spoke to about it said they remember it being a very closed circle word for barbershops, colloquial in love, but only to be used, you know, in that sort of barbershop situation where, you know, there are only black people around. And the difference and their quibble with the hip-hop generation's more public usage of it is that they're sort of shouting it from rooftops and on subway platforms for all to hear rather than using it as a closed circle word. But I interviewed Jesse Jackson for about an hour and a half for this book after the tape recorder went off. We're just talking, and he's with some friends too, and they're just talking. And he just said the N-word, just like, yeah, you know, just colloquially, not in hatred, but in, yeah, we got to get those ends more motivated. And I was like, whoa, what was that? What did you just do right there? And he says, what are you talking about? I didn't say that. And I'm like, yes, you did. I heard you. And so he kind of thought back. He's like, oh, I kind of did. And, you know, he talked about that, you know, that he shouldn't, but, you know, like that old habits sort of die hard, and that this is part of Black preacher culture, that this exists far back as just sort of a word that a lot of the preachers use. And we talked with Cornel West about how Dr. King is recorded having used the N-word at least toward the end of his life, if not earlier, you know, to refer to, you know, one of his friends. So, I mean, this is just something that has been part of Black preacher culture for a long time, you know, and just Black male culture for a long time, just that we've sort of bent it to use it another way, partly inspired by Richard Pryor, but also by others. Richard Pryor really sort of helps transform the usage of it into this sort of public tool.
So we don't run out of time here. I need to get some callers in here.
Let's do it.
You've got to get down to do your piece.
Oh, wow. Is it 7:15?
No, it's not. It's only 6. Going on 6:30.
Yeah, your clock is wrong on the wall.
That clock. Pay no attention to that clock.
Well, it's partly right. It's just an hour ahead.
It's 410-319-8888. Timothy, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you so much, Mark. And how are you today?
I'm well, man. Welcome.
Hey Torre, man. How are you, my friend?
Good, man. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I catch you on MSNBC a lot. And
thank you.
Torre, I'm just going to share this with you, and I'm going to be brutally honest with you. You haven't lived long enough to really get a grip of what you're expounding. And Mark, you got to give us more time. He filibustered. Torre just go on and on. He just talks so much.
Well, that's what he's here for.
So, Torre, I would like for you to... Torre, you just made a statement. You said Dr. King have used that word. First and foremost, I'm glad you had a change of heart not to use the N-word, and I'm proud of you. And that's a mark of someone who's growing up, and I appreciate that. But, Torre, you espoused some ridiculous ideals about what blackness is about, and I am shocked.
Well, why don't you get one? So we have to get out of here.
Yeah,
now.
Like
so
what?
Give me one.
So, number now, you just I'm going to share this because you spell, you know, you filibustered the whole topic here, but you just said Dr. Martin Luther King used the N-word. I want you to find and play for us, if you find it, from Dr. Cornel West, like you said, that he said ever anything like that in public or in any of his speeches.
Okay, well, let me,
Torre.
And I will bow at your feet if you do.
And you'll do what?
Bow at your feet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't need that, but it'd be, you know, Dr. Cornel West is, you know, an unimpeachable scholar who certainly didn't say that, you know, just sort of off the cuff. You know, we had an extensive conversation about that, and that happened, you know. I mean, you know, the word has been in the community for a long time, and it's certainly not something that I'm espousing. I mean, I'm not proselytizing against the brothers using it, but I've made a personal decision not to use it, so I'm not espousing anything in this situation. But I mean, you know, this is a point of history. You know, certainly he knew better, as we talked about closed circle words, he knew better than to go into a public speech,
right,
and say it. That's not what men of that generation did, but he did use it in private spaces.
Now, I hate to do this story, but
I know, I want to give him another second because he said I filibustered and I'm saying all kinds of crazy things.
You're the guest.
I know. It's certainly not the correct use of the word filibuster. But are we done? Can he ask another question?
No,
can he make another point?
We can't do that, unfortunately. We just run out of time. But I want to encourage everybody who has more to say to Torre.
Come to the library.
Go to the library, Central Branch, right now, 7:30. Get something to eat before on your way down. Torre, Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, will be there with Michael Eric Dyson, who wrote the foreword to his book. And we'll be there to talk with you.
And filibuster.
He'll be on stage again. It'll be his time again. Sorry. So we have to have a very brief break and come back. And we come back. Bernard Avishai joins us to talk about why an Israeli is talking about Palestinians' rights to a land of return as well. Stay with us.